The Wisdom of the Wild by Don Schatz. There is wisdom in wildness. I don't mean misbehavior, but real wildness, elemental wildness, animal wildness. There is wisdom in the wildness of the wolf, whose rhythms are completely attuned to the truth of the earth, who leaves silent paw prints in a world we can only taste but never truly touch. There is wisdom in the wildness of the moose, in whose powerful legs can be found surprising grace. There is wisdom in the songbirds, whose lives border our own, yet whose music will never be tamed. There is wisdom in wildness. We are not wild, whatever pretensions we may have. Human language and society will always be imprinted upon us. We cannot escape them. We can, though, learn from the wildness of others. We can learn to listen to our senses, smell, taste, sound, touch, sight, and the indefinable instinct that we have almost but not quite forgotten. There is wisdom in wildness, and though we are not wild, there will always remain wildness in us. We touch it when we are at peace with nature, when our senses are heightened, when we become one with our surroundings, whatever they may be. We taste it when we are in love. And when we have given ourselves to the long and difficult work of tuning our minds, our homes, and our communities to the needs of the greater earth, then we will have begun to live the wisdom of the wild.
Wild. Wildness, to be wild. Humans have had a conflicted relationship with wildness for many centuries. What does the word wild conjure for you? We say that the children are running wild, meaning out of control, possibly destructive. And yet we also associate wildness with integrity, purity, simplicity. Wildness is also associated with wilderness, the place where the wild things are, the untouched land. Wilderness is a state of mind as well as a state of nature. In German, the word for wilderness has two meanings embedded in it. Wildnis is the word for the wild woods of the Brothers Grimm, mysterious and threatening, filled with scary creatures and unknown dangers. And wildnis also means sanctuary, where you can find consolation and respite from civilization. These differing meanings say so much about our conflicted relationship with wildness. Of course, the whole idea of wildness only has meaning in contrast to the idea of civilization. Before there were human enclaves and cities, there was no wildness. There just was. There is no wild if there's no civilized. For the earliest humans, the goal was simply to survive in the world, to control enough of nature to be able to eat, find shelter, and keep from being eaten. But as humans progressed, our need for control extended as far as was humanly possible. The first European settlers in North America came about at a time when there were few wild places left in Europe, and the North American continent was ripe for civilizing. To the Puritans and other early settlers, the wilderness and the native people who lived in them seemed immoral and without value until they could be tamed and reordered to serve the needs that God had ordained. This attitude carried our pioneers across the nation in a manifest destiny to control the lands from sea to sea. During the first three centuries of our country, wilderness was considered the enemy of man, and the goal was to conquer the heathen forces of wilderness and civilize them. It wasn't until the early 19th century that new awareness of nature came into being. The Transcendentalists, led by Unitarian minister Ralph Waldo Emerson, turned the tables on this idea that of what was heathen and what was divine. Instead of believing that God intended us to civilize nature, Emerson proposed that God was present in the wilderness. God was there in the natural, in the wild. Wilderness was not to be feared, but embraced as a way to God. Nature allowed us to transcend the ordinary and connect with the divine. Henry David Thoreau took these teachings to heart. Many of us read his book, Walden, when we were in high school. These were his reflections during the years he spent living in a cabin on Walden Pond near Concord, Massachusetts. For Thoreau, wilderness was a source of vigor, inspiration, and strength. He called it an essential raw material of life. Yet even for Thoreau, wilderness could push him into uncharted areas. Leaving behind the comparatively tame wildness of Concord, where he would have lunch every day with his mother, leaving his cabin on Walden Pond, Thoreau journeyed to the true wilds of Maine, where he found a landscape savage and dreary. In his writings after this journey, he asked himself the existential questions that all humans face. Who are we? What is our place in this world? What is the meaning of our lives? Thoreau's ideas of God and transcendence were challenged by questions of human insignificance when he faced true wildness.
The Peace of Wild Things by Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water. And I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free.
These words of Wendell Berry strike a chord for many of us. Nature and wildness as a source of respite and inspiration. But for most of our country's history, these words would have fallen on deaf ears. The Transcendentalists were ahead of their time. But by the beginning of the 20th century, the country was ready for some ideas expressed through the life and words of John Muir. Teddy Roosevelt was part of this change. He challenged people to love the wilderness rather than conquer it. And the country was ready to romanticize wilderness. John Muir took the ideas of the Transcendentalists and brought them to a country more receptive to this message. For Muir, nature provided the best conductor of divinity. For him, forests were temples and trees were psalm singing. Unlike Thoreau, who was terrified by the wilds of Maine, Muir was not daunted by the extreme wilderness and made many a solitary hike throughout the Sierras and other wild areas. He said, "I am often asked if I am not lonesome on my solitary excursions. It seems so evident that one cannot be lonesome where everything is wild and beautiful and busy and steeped with God." Muir's sensibilities have been passed down to many of us who find solace, restoration, and inspiration in wilderness. We can't be whole without it. Some philosophers and theologians agree. The Catholic theologian Thomas Berry believed that what he called the outer world, the wilderness, the natural world, is necessary to have an inner world. It's necessary for the health of our spirit and our psyche. He said that if we don't have certain outer experiences, we don't have certain inner experiences. Or at least, we don't have them in the same profound way. We need the sun and the moon and the stars and the rivers and the mountains and the birds and the fish in the sea. We need them to evoke a world of mystery, to evoke the sacred. Many of us appreciate that hiking and being in nature away from our normal lives can be a transcendent and transformative experience. There is fear that children who have what is called nature deficit disorder, that is, lack of any connection with nature in their lives, there's fear that they will be disordered in other ways, disconnected from this deeper meaning. Now, of course, in the 21st century, connection with wildness and the natural world does not actually require you to leave your home. Many of us have been captivated by the story of OR7, the first wild wolf in Western Oregon in 60 years, and then when he migrated south to California, he became the first wolf in California in 80 years. Humans had killed all the wolves in North America by 1960, except for a few remaining in Canada, Alaska, and northern Minnesota. Wolves, as seen, were seen as competitors with hunters and were threatening to livestock. OR7 and his kin came to Oregon through a program to reestablish the wolves that started in 2002. But it's not just wild wolves that have captivated people. At any one time, there are millions of people logged on to nature cams trained on wild animals. Now, these are not zoo pandas or carefully edited nature documentaries, but animals living in the wild, doing the things that wild animals do. You can see whooping cranes, polar bears, sea lions, and many other species. As we speak, as we gather, there are likely 500,000 people turned to a webcam in Texas that is beaming through the internet a family of great horned owls. And it is more likely than not that these great horned owls are sleeping. Now, what function do these webcams serve for people? Does it help relieve their loneliness? Does it help them feel connected to something in this great world? Help them remember their wild nature? Are the wild animal cams one current version of what Wendell Berry extols as the peace of the wild things? The next best thing to being there? There is one human-animal story that really expresses the complexity of our relationship with wildness. I want to share this story with you as told by the New York Times columnist John Mulalem. The bald eagle incident in Minnesota started like this. One Thursday night in early May, people watching the Eagle Cam, run by the Non-Game Wildlife Program of the state's Department of Natural Resources, noticed that one of the three eagle chicks in the nest was immobile. It appeared to be suffering. Bald eagle chicks are endearing, but not in any traditional sense cute. Their unwieldy, disproportionate wings and legs wind up contorting into all sorts of crazy tangles when they lie around in the nest. But regardless, the Eagle Cam audience had grown intensely attached to these three young birds. After all, many had been following the Eagle Cam since the eggs had been laid. Now, the Non-Game Wildlife Program makes a point of not naming the birds, but on Facebook, fans had taken to calling them Snap, Crackle, and Pop. Snap was the one having trouble. The little bird couldn't get up to eat. Clearly, it wouldn't survive any longer. By the next morning, the non-game wildlife program was bombarded by emails, phone calls, notes on social media, pleading with it to step in and get Snap some medical attention. Now, the non-game wildlife program has a policy to let nature play out and intervene. It doesn't want to compromise the essential eagleness of the eagles on the eagle cam. In an informational video about the eagle cam that the agency produced, it addresses this exact situation hypothetically. We're not going to turn the camera off. We're not going to climb in the nest to try and save any chicks. The agency had posted the video the previous day, only hours before anyone noticed that Snap was struggling. The public outcry was getting more hostile as the day went on. It became hard to ignore. The emails kept coming. They were emphatic. Some were written in all caps. Now, the non-game wildlife program doesn't disclose the eagle nest location, but a few people threatened to find it and rescue Snap themselves. Finally, late in the afternoon, the program got a call from the governor's office. They were getting pummeled with calls, too, and wanted to know how the program intended to play this. A decision was made. Within a couple of hours, two utility workers got into a bucket truck and gently lifted Snap out of the nest. The chick wasn't stuck in the mud. It was badly injured, most likely trampled accidentally by one of its parents. It had a severely fractured wing and a systemic infection. There was no chance of recovery. Snap had to be euthanized. "Fly high and free, little Snap. You taught us humans so much," one Eagle Cam viewer posted a few days later on Facebook. The mood online was mournful but grateful. There were frowny-faced emoji and bulging pink hearts. Hundreds of people thanked the non-game wildlife program for listening to them and helping the chick, if only helping him die a more comfortable death. The community of Eagle Cam viewers felt it had been spared a lot of discomfort, too. "Thanks," one woman wrote, "for not making us suffer by watching it die. I'm not up for that learning experience." So the viewers of this Eagle Cam want their wildness, want it with very little difficulty for themselves, but they don't want it to be too wild. And if it gets too uncomfortable, they want the authorities to make it okay. The people who create and manage these cameras are hoping that by watching wild animals on their computers, people will come to appreciate the importance of wildness. But clearly, from the behavior of those who view the Eagle Cam, their appreciation of wildness requires that humans intervene when things get too wild. We don't want it to get out of control. We can't let wild animals be.
The modern ambition to control nature is an ambition based foursquare on a superstition. The idea that what we take nature to be is what nature is, or that nature is that to which it can be reduced. If nature is to be controlled, then it has to be reduced to that which is theoretically controllable. It must be understood as a machine or as the sum of its known, separable, and decipherable parts. Care, on the other hand, rests upon genuine religion. Care allows creatures to escape our explanations into their actual presence and their essential mystery. In taking care of fellow creatures, we acknowledge that they are not ours. We acknowledge that they belong to an order and an harmony of which we ourselves are part. to answer the perpetual crisis of our presence in this abounding and dangerous world, we have only the perpetual obligation of care. We are dealing with issues of health in its largest and also in its most literal sense. Creaturely orders and communities that are whole. And so we see that we must be whole ourselves, for the good solutions must come from our wholeness, our affection and reverence, not from our sense of duty, much less from desperation. We have tried on a large scale the experiment of preferring ourselves to the exclusion of all other creatures, with results that are manifestly disastrous.
Those words from Wendell Berry are full of challenges. First, he is telling us that we shouldn't try to understand or control nature. We are now, as a species, sophisticated enough in our appreciation of systems to know that it is folly to consider nature more than the sum of its component parts. And it is folly to think that we truly understand these natural systems. And we are just starting to understand the implications of the damage that we have done to the systems of the natural world. Berry says, let nature be, find a new way to care. And care, he says, allows creatures to escape our explanations into their actual presence and their essential mystery. Berry tells us that we must achieve a degree of wholeness within ourselves before we can approach our relationship with wildness, our relationship with the natural world. He says, we must ourselves be whole, for good solutions must come from our wholeness, our affection and reverence, not from our sense of duty, much less from desperation. I see part of this wholeness, an essential part of this wholeness, to be balance. Balance between our need for civilization and our need for wildness. Balance in our need for knowing and understanding and our need for mystery. Balance in our perspective and the role of wilderness in our world. Another part of that wholeness is maturity. We have to stop being greedy children, sucking up the world, the resources of the world, to serve our own materialistic needs. And part of that wholeness requires humility. Our future as a species rests on our ability to understand that we are not in charge. We are, in fact, dependent on the natural systems of the earth. As one of our UU principles, we covenant to uphold and respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. For me, the key words here are of which we are a part, not the interdependent web of which we are in charge or the interdependent web of which we are in control, but the interdependent web of which we are a part. Thoreau heard this message when he stood on that mountain in Maine and felt the existential angst of human existence. Who are we? What is our place in the order of things? We are simply one small piece in this great universe. As a species, if we cannot find the maturity to care and the humility to accept our place in the interdependent web, then it is likely that there will not be humans on this earth in some future. You see, the wildness does not need us. The world will heal from our presence. But humans need wildness. We need it for our spirits, our connections to something greater than ourselves. We need it for the lessons it teaches, the reminders of what is important, the reminders of what is essential. Wildness does not need humans, but for humans, wildness is a necessity. So may it be.